Raising women's voices, one story at a time. Welcome to the She Said Project Podcast. This has been an amazing season of the She Said Project Podcast, where Jeanette and Carrie in the studio have gotten to hang out and chat with some really incredible women who have braved the microphone for one night only on stage in a performance of That's What She Said. Carrie, how are you doing today?
Fabulous. Fabulous. And I love the podcast so much because you get to know these women. You get to just fall in love with them. And then poof, the show's over and everybody goes back to real life. And so I love the podcast, like asking all the like, so what's up now?
You get the story behind the story. Yeah. It's become kind of an urban legend. It's become a thing at rehearsals when we cast a new show and the women are working really hard on finding their stories for the final performance. And then they have to leave stuff out, right? Because there's only so much time they get on stage. They can't share the whole story. And it's become kind of a phrase that's been growing in the She Said-isphere. Save it for the podcast. We'll talk about it on the podcast because there is so much more that we could talk about. One of our recent producers said this to me. She said, you know, we kept the stories nice and short because we want to leave the audience wanting more. And that is a great way to look at it.
I agree. I love the save it for the podcast. And then the people who have a raunchier story or something with curse words that we don't allow in the show, it's great because it's like, oh, okay, save that because you can drop all of that when we're on the podcast.
We still have editing technology. We can bleep them out if we need to.
She's looking at me right now. They bleep me all the time.
You know who we don't have to bleep out, though? Our amazing guest today. She nailed her story. It had laughter. It had tears. We were on the edge of our seats. And you got to know this woman, the charming, insightful, adorable, kind, and yet feisty and maybe a little bit raunchy side of Monica Bullington, who was on stage. And that's what she said not too long ago in Bloomington Normal. Monica, are you on the line with us?
Hello, friends.
Welcome to the She Said Project Podcast.
Thank you. And I didn't know you were offering cuss words because I'm very fluent in profanity.
As a matter of fact,
get your edit button ready.
Monica got herself a little bit of a reputation with her cast. Every time there was a text message that went through the group, if it had some dirty words, it was probably Monica.
Odds are high. That's Monica.
Yeah,
that is awesome.
It's not something I was aware of until it was pointed out at me, but I don't have children. I don't have to edit myself very much in life, so I don't.
I have four kiddos and I work in education, so I have to be filtered all the time. And so when I am not in one of those atmospheres, then it's just been bottled up and then I just have to like let them all out.
I see.
I feel like She Said is your outlet sometimes.
It really is. Yeah. It really is. No more knock-knock jokes. Like, let's get right to it.
So Monica, let's dive right in. The story you shared on stage was very personal, as they tend to be, but it had to do with your relationship with your parents and some unique dynamics of your family. Do you want to share with our listeners a little bit about what you chose to share?
Yeah. I grew up in a bit of a chaotic household. My father was an alcoholic for most of my life. I actually had to text my sister and ask her one day when I was writing this, like, was he an alcoholic my whole life? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, oh, I didn't know. It was normal to me, and it took some time to realize that. So part of the story is about learning how to cope with that. And then part of the story is also my mom passed away when I was 23. It's been a rough time, and I had certain ways of dealing with that that led me down a great career, but also kept me from exploring a lot of issues with my past. I honestly thought that most of my quote-unquote issues was because my mom died when I was 23, and I never looked past that. And then all of a sudden I realized, oh, there's all of that stuff with your dad before that that maybe you should look at too. And that got me down a whole rabbit hole, and the story came out of that.
I have to agree. You used this opportunity as a chance to dive deeper and reflect on who you are today and what got you there. So let's not keep our listeners waiting any longer. Let's go ahead and listen to the recording of your story, because I think this is going to give them some insight. Please enjoy this performance by Monica Bullington on stage. And that's what she said, Bloomington Normal 2023, with her story, Nacho Love.
So I know we all think that our parents are like the most embarrassing people on the planet, but I'm going to tell you about my dad, and then we can all agree that I'm right. So growing up, my dad loved when we had friends over, because he loves feeding people. So a room full of kids playing Mario Kart was a gold mine for him. And his favorite thing to feed us kids? Nachos. But not the kind of nachos you guys are probably thinking of. You're probably picturing whole-sized tortilla chips, fresh hot queso, maybe some salsa, guacamole. No, 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 no. My dad made his with whatever crumbs were left at the bottom of whatever bag of chips he found. Usually, steel Doritos. Sometimes, sour cream and onion. Then he'd sprinkle some shredded cheese on top and microwave it. And if we were really lucky, he'd scrape the mold off of some sour cream and put that on top. Off, not the mold on it, okay? My friends, by the way, thought this was awesome. I thought it was mortifying. But it wasn't just because of the nachos. See, my dad also loves Hawaiian shirts and short shorts. Yep, so picture this. I'm hanging out with my friends, and in comes my dad wearing a mostly, if not completely, unbuttoned Hawaiian shirt, classic dad New Balance shoes, and homemade Daisy Dukes. But the most stressful part of this situation was actually the fact that he was always drunk. And when I saw him come in, all I could see was a drunken embarrassment. And by the ninth grade, I had completely perfected the "Dad, go away" whine. But somehow, despite the staggered saunter, the weird clothes, and the shit-eating grin on his face, my friends never seemed to realize he was drunk. They just thought he was really goofy. And beyond my social mortification, his drinking caused a lot of problems at our house growing up. And by the time I was in high school, my mom's patience with his drinking was wearing thin, increasing the fighting and the tension. And unfortunately for me, both my sisters, who used to shield me from all of this chaos, had moved out. So it was just me, my parents, and the yelling. And most of my memories of being in high school at home were actually of hiding from my screaming parents or consoling my mom, who seemed to have more drama in her life than her teenage daughter. So I went to school and stayed there as much as possible to avoid them. And between theater and speech team and the newspaper, I was able to avoid them most nights and weekends. But this also became a way of getting attention. Because you have to go to your kids' plays, right? And you can't be screaming at each other in the middle of one. Every morning on show nights, I would plead with my dad, "Please don't drink tonight." And every night he would tell me he wouldn't. But what I fail to account for is that you don't stop being an alcoholic just because your kid is in a play that night. And yet, every single time, I would think, this is going to be the night he shows up sober. It was never that night. And the worst thing in the whole world was trying to find my parents after the show and seeing his telltale signs of drunkenness. That red face and sloppy posture evoked so much rage, but mostly disappointment. Those nights always ended with me crying and my mom yelling at my dad for not being able to be sober. I think I naively thought that if I could show him how great I was, that he would feel like he had enough in the world and he didn't need alcohol. winning awards and performing were my way of saying, look, Dad, everyone else sees how great I am. Why don't you? Not surprisingly, my parents divorced as soon as I went away to college, leaving neither of them with much money. Now, my dad, he's always been cheap, so his life didn't really change much. But my mom, she had expensive taste that she could not sustain on her own. So she rotated between asking my dad, her new boyfriend, my sisters, and her student loan dependent daughter for money. And while I was at school, my friends were getting credit cards from their parents, and I was writing checks to my mom. Guilty if I ever thought about saying no. It shouldn't have surprised me that when she died a few years later in 2012, she still didn't have any money. But it was at this moment that I realized how much she was depending on her boyfriend to pay her bills, and this devastated me. This turned me into a complete freak about money. I was so afraid of turning out like my mom, just making decisions based on what a man could buy me. So this, coupled with my underlying need for praise and attention, is what turned me into such a high-producing realtor. I filled the voids in my life with work because I needed the money and the awards to feel safe and loved. My workaholic tendencies eventually led me to burnout. But burnout sounds like a quaint phrase, right? It kind of sounds like I just died peacefully in my sleep. But burnout feels like a high-speed car chase. You know, the ones you see in the movie with way more flips and flames than necessary. Slowly, I recovered. But in my recovery, I found myself annoyed at how much my burnout was digging up all of this stuff from my past. And suddenly, I had to add work through daddy issues to my to-do list. I was knee-deep in my 200th self-help book when I read the quote, "Forgiveness is giving up all hope for a better past." Man, did that hit, because I'll tell you, I sure do like blaming my parents for everything. And forgiving them means becoming responsible for myself. And I'm just not sure I'm ready to adult that hard, guys. But what do I actually have to forgive my parents for? At first, I thought it was for not loving me enough to have their shit together. But after I thought about it, I knew we were always loved, albeit not always the ways that we wanted. I may not have gotten all the pats on the back that I craved, but I did get a hell of a lot of nachos. And I even have this ring that my sister had made after my mom died, with the engraving inside that says, "Always loved." See, I'm not sure I'm ready to forgive my parents for all of their parental sins. But this is about me moving forward. And in order for me to move forward, I do have to forgive them for one thing. Being human. For being imperfect people just trying to do their best while raising three girls and fighting through all the bullshit that their parents gave them. I had to forgive them for having their own problems. Problems that sometimes clouded, but never erased the fact that I am always loved.
I mean, I will never look at another plate of nachos the same way again after experiencing that story with you. What a unique memory, like so specific, but yet it was so significant for you in your childhood and your upbringing, yeah. Relating your dad to these moments when you had friends over and, you know, serving of the nachos. What brought that up? Yeah. What brought that memory up for you?
I think because this summer, as I was writing it, or last summer, whatever, I was learning about the situation, and it reminded me of when I was learning about it as a, like, in the moment, grappling with understanding my dad was different. I thought he was normal, and it, so it just took me back there of, like, when I first was kind of learning that things were different, and it happened a lot. I mean, he was obviously drunk all the time, and I always had friends over. You would think if I was so embarrassed, I wouldn't bring people over, but the other part, alcoholic dad, he can't drive you places, so I guess the alternative was I brought people to my house and didn't know that he was as embarrassing as he was, I guess.
And your story, I loved the way you delivered it. Something that speaks to me always is to say hard things. It's easier for people to hear it if you're laughing first. So a lot of times speakers, I feel like, oh, they're my new BFF. Oh, I love them. And I felt like you were one of my sisters because we all love to deliver really hard things while we're belly laughing.
Yeah.
And so I loved your approach of mixing the two things of you were really
Thank
funny.
You.
And then it really sort of made it easy to deliver some hard shares.
Yeah. I think that's the role as like the youngest child is yeah. you grow up. All I want to do is make my sisters laugh. Like, that's my number one goal in life, is if I can make those two laugh, like, I'm thrilled. So I've just been born with, like, I learned, I guess, how to make people laugh and get attention that way. That was one of my my attention getting skills.
Yeah, but also served as a defense mechanism. You know, it served as your protection almost to negate what was really going on behind the scenes. And as I got to know you more, you certainly went down this long path of self-discovery and self-help, and you read a lot of books. I love that you shared kind of the journey in your story of realizing your role and your parents' role, and the only way for you to move forward was through forgiveness.
Yeah. I remember exactly where I was when I was reading that. And what the listeners may not realize, like, I was building a new business as I was writing the script. So I was already digging in my past to build this new consulting business to help people with burnout. So it required me to look back. So I was already like kind of poking around back there. That's why I think the timing was so great for us, is because I was already kind of knee deep in like what's going on back there. So it was really helpful to have an audience, and my sisters, you know, my she said sisters, of kind of like bouncing some of these like feelings and stuff. But I was in my backyard reading that quote and just be like, oh, yeah, you know, like that means I have to do something about this now. And, but then also kind of the relief that was like, I get to do something about this now. Like, I think I can move forward. Like, this is great. Great news.
Well, two things. How do you feel looking back on it now? What kind of impact did telling that have? And then what was the reaction from your loved ones?
I loved it. I had a background in speech, and so I used to hide from my family by giving 8-minute speeches, and now I'm giving an 8-minute speech to talk about how, like, it was very meta for me. It really felt like it was kind of like closing a circle there, and it felt really complete. And I really loved that I could use those skills that I learned in that difficult time to express how that was a difficult time. My oldest sister was in the audience, and I thought I told her what it was about.
Oh, no.
I probably kept it kind of vague on purpose because, you know, I'm a theater person. I like to, you know, have a moment. And she missed half of Sonia's after because she had to go to the bathroom because her, like, face was falling off. Yeah, she had a very strong reaction, but I think the hard part with sisters and family members is my experience was the same but so different. Because I'm 10 years younger than Emily, and I'm 4 years younger than Christina. So, like, for them to hear these things that I was going through, they were like, no, it wasn't that bad. I was like, well, not when you were around, but times changed. And when, you know, when things were at its worst, it was very different than what you experienced. And I think that made them feel sad and bad for me that I had to go through that kind of alone, because they were they were out of the house by then, and they deserved to move on with their lives and build their futures, but I was still kind of stuck there waiting it out.
Yeah, everybody is sort of paying the tab in their own way.
Yeah, you shared that when they lived at home, they were kind of a buffer for you. And when they were gone, yeah. Obviously you were the only one there to handle the relationship with your parents. And so, of course, it was going to change the dynamics and make it more intense. And I loved how you owned your theater moment, you know, like, look at me, that you took the stage for attention. But that's what any kid would have done, you know, in that situation.
Yeah, you try one thing and you get a little like, oh, that kind of worked. And I'm like, what else can I do, you know? And when you're as sick as my dad was, he couldn't, and I see that now, and I have a lot of empathy for what he went through, but he couldn't see me in the ways that he wanted to, and it wasn't, you know, a fault of his, and I understand that, and we're building a better relationship. He's actually been sober for the last, I think it's been 8 or 9 years since the fall of 2015, right as I got my real estate license, actually. I know exactly when it was. So we've been able to rebuild a different sort of relationship since then, which has been pretty cool.
That's amazing. I loved
He just like quit cold turkey, which really annoyed me, by the way.
No, I do remember you sharing that, because why is it that he can do it now and he couldn't do it then when you needed it?
Yeah. But, you know, you have to be ready for yourself in that moment. And he eventually got himself to that place, and I'm super proud of him. And we're figuring out a new dynamic here still.
But I think the theme that you shared that every single person can relate to was that moment when you realize your parents are human, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if, you know, if they are alcoholics or have any complicated situation, but there is a humbling moment, a depressing moment. I don't know. There's a moment,
yeah.
Right, when you're an adult and you realize, oh, yes, they are human too. And we have to offer them the same grace that we would any other relationship that we have as adults in this world. And like you said, I don't know that, you know, we're all ready to adult that hard.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny to see, like, as an adult, and see friends that have problems and the advice I would give them, the way they would treat them. And you're like, oh, of course I would treat you with such, you know, humanity and respect and stuff like that. But your parents, you just expect the world of them. And it's almost not fair that we set them up. They were our lives for so long, to expect so much out of them.
Yeah, but you feel it really hard when they can't deliver, and it can take you down some interesting paths for sure. Let's talk for a second. So you didn't go into too much detail, but I'd love to share with our listeners that piece of your journey where you discovered, you know, that your mom was so reliant on her relationships for financial support, and it sent you off on a journey where you had to become the best and the most successful. And not everybody knows that you were awarded Realtor of the Year in the Bloomington Normal community because of the work that you put in. And then what happened? There was a moment somewhere between then and now where you realized that that wasn't what you needed. Success and joy were not the same thing, right?
Yeah, after my mom passed, we found out she had no money. She was worth more dead than alive. And I hate to say that, but that's like a fact. Her life insurance was worth more than any money she had in her bank account, which still was not much. Her boyfriend paid her rent, and she was waiting for him to leave his wife. And he just kept saying, it's going to happen, it's going to happen. And my mom died with this hope that she was going to be with this man someday, and it never happened. And that frankly pissed me off. I became a huge producer, and I got a lot of attention, and I got a lot of money, and I just was like, okay, I'm safe in my little bubble here, and I'll just take care of myself, because no man is ever going to do that. And I'm married to an attorney, and I was like, your money is not enough. It's not good enough. I need my own to feel safe. And so that took a lot of time to kind of undo. The whole turning point was in the fall of 2001 when I won Realtor of the Year. I was like, whoa, crap, what do I do now? Like, I don't want to get better than this. Like, I was selling close to 50 houses every year. I worked from the minute I woke up to the minute I went to bed. I ruined every movie night my husband and I ever tried to have. It was no thank you. And I didn't know why I was trying so hard. And then just a couple months later was the 10-year anniversary of my mom's death. And that was when I really was starting to put some things together. My burnout keeps getting brought up when I think of this grief over my mom. Like, how are these things related? Why am I such an overachiever? And why does it always kind of circle back to my mom? And I posted on Facebook and had amazing conversations with people, just being really real. I think that's why I feel so comfortable in the She Said atmosphere. It's because I got used to saying the ugly stuff out there, because it connected me in more ways than I ever got connected to people trying to be the best, most perfect person. And now I'm like obsessed with it. And I'm like, do you want to hear the time I shit my pants? Like, I'll tell you if that means that we're going to be friends. Like, just call me up. We'll talk, because that just gets you so much farther in life.
Oh, that's awesome.
Sorry, you didn't know I was going there, but I didn't see that coming.
We love women who are willing to go there, to be quite honest, because this world is not as pretty as this picture that we're constantly painting for each other. It is awkward and gross and silly and weird. And we love women who embrace that. So yes, thanks for bringing it. But what came out of this for you that was so beautiful is you took your struggle and emerged with a coaching business to help others prevent this type of burnout. How has that been going for you?
Oh my gosh. Every day is a new lesson. Like, it's, you have to constantly be pivoting. So what I learned was I wanted everything to be perfect. And then I realized I just had to start. And my first iteration of a business was real estate focused. And I was like, well, this isn't right. But I had tried and I learned. So then I was able to make tweak after tweak after tweak till I got it to what actually inspired the hell out of me. I was like, this is it, you know, but I didn't know that I had to go through all of these drafts. And usually I'm the type of person that those drafts stay under lock and key. No one sees the draft. You see the finished product that is perfect. And I tried something new this time and I feel so much better. It's the stress level, like a bajillion times lower when I can just try something out loud and learn from it and go. So I've been making a lot of great connections, especially with a lot of your help, Janessa. Thank you. Some great connections at the She Said conference. So now I'm trying to get in front of as many business owners. I offer burnout recovery coaching, but really I would love to get in front of it where we can prevent it and work with companies and actually do the work before they get to the point of burnout. But that's hard to do because it's everywhere right now.
Well, I don't know any university that offers a degree in burnout management, but I love that you're tackling this because, I mean, it was probably prevalent before, but post-COVID, oh my gosh, burnout is so high. And there isn't a system, there isn't a method, you know, to get ahead of it or figure it out once it's gone too far. No one's doing that work. And so I think that's really exciting.
Well, I'm really interested, as you were talking, I'm fascinated by this. And I'm wondering if there's sort of this connection between all of these facets in your own puzzle, connecting it, thinking so many women in our generation have seen our mothers or grandmothers who did not have financial independence, and the fallout from that. And so then we become, that's not going to be me. We work, and got to be the best. And then that leads to burnout.
Yeah.
You know, I'm wondering if those things are connected.
What I'm finding is so much of a person's past. I was annoyed at how much of the stuff from my childhood causes the burnout. I kind of say it's like a wound. Like, you have a wound on your arm and you put a Band-Aid on it. And that might be figuring out your time management and clearing your schedule and stuff like that. But it doesn't help you figure out why did you get hurt in the first place. And it certainly doesn't stop you from getting hurt. That gives you the moment to pause and breathe. But you really need to figure out why you got hurt in the first place so you can stop getting hurt. And that's kind of where a lot of my work comes from, is like looking in the ugly past to figure out why are you accepting the circumstances and why are you promoting this hustle culture and living this life. And so that's what I've been figuring out this year.
It's certainly a service, I think, that is well needed in our communities these days. So thank you for you taking these risks and diving into your own story. You're only going to help other women, other people find their own peace and find their own burnout prevention. That's what we try to do. And that's what she said. Give women a safe space to discover these stories where they can dig a little deeper. They can get ahead of the story. Maybe they can put some antiseptic on the wound a little bit, you know. And you certainly dove in from day one. I didn't tell you, Carrie, but like Monica, the very first time we got together, her overachiever is showing a little bit. You know, she came with the perfect draft, ready to roll. It was so good.
I don't know if it's not the overachiever. It's honestly, I think, the years of having done this in high school. Like, I mean, I did get a lot of awards and like went through state and nationals and stuff. So I attribute it to like, I just have some technical skills that. Mm-hmm. Up for a good a little obsessive, like perfectionist, just a cherry on top.
Well, thank you for bringing all your technical skills and talents to That's What She Said. That's all the time we have for today's episode, but Monica, thank you for spending some time with us, for revisiting your story and the story behind the story, which is what we love to dive into and explore. We're here to share stories on a greater platform so more women can learn. More women can learn how to prevent burnout and be like Monica.
Be like Monica. Bumper stickers coming soon.
Our new bumper sticker. Thanks, everyone, for joining us today on the She Said Project podcast.
Over and out.
Thank you for listening to the She Said Project podcast in partnership with Illinois Public Media. All materials contained in the podcast are the exclusive property of the She Said Project and That's What She Said LLC. For more information on our live shows, go to shesaidproject.com. This podcast was made possible with support from Carl and Health Alliance and presented by Sterling Wealth Management, empowering women to live their best lives. We just got you a new slogan,
thank you,
girl.
Monica.